This podcast is brought to you by MyBookie. Are you the type of fan that knows football so well that you could choose any game and call it? Well, MyBookie is the place for you because they let you turn all your sports knowledge into cash in your wallet. Between football season, NBA, and the start of college basketball season, it's time to get off the sideline and get in on the action with MyBookie. If you're the kind of guy who likes to bet a little to win a lot, try a parlay. For instance, if you like a couple of the big favorites this week, parlays are perfect because they let you bet multiple games together for a much bigger payout. So if you're going to bet this season, do the smart thing and go to mybookie.ag because no one gives you more ways to win. Tired of watching the games from the couch with nothing to gain? MyBookie wants to get your mind off everything else and back on the game. If you join right now, MyBookie will match your deposit halfway, all the way up to $1,000. That means if you deposit $2,000, you get an extra $1,000 in free money to play with. Just enter promo code MENACE to activate the offer. Once again, that's promo code MENACE to take advantage of MyBookie's generous sign-up offer. Visit mybookie.ag today. You play, you win, you get paid. It is Wednesday, December 11th. Welcome to Menace to Sports, Championship Week Recap Edition, and playoff projections, predictions, discussions. Thank you for joining us. Really, really excited about this episode. And I wanted to apologize before we even get started. This episode was going to go out yesterday. So I'm reformatting, kind of trying to figure out exactly how we're going to move forward. We're going to go to two episodes a week, kind of try to lengthen them a little bit, beef them up with some interviews, some more content, and stick to two episodes a week so it's easier to listen and you don't fall behind. I know I actually just talked to a guy today at the gym who was like, man, I'm like 3 weeks behind, but I'm trying to catch up. And he actually was like, it's crazy. Like, I'm listening to 3 weeks ago and all the stuff you're talking about ended up, like, hindsight 2020, it all panned out. It's wild. But trying to revamp this platform and how it's going to get released. But yesterday was, I got a lot going on right now, so it's been kind of crazy. But thank you for being patient. Really excited. Dude, had some construction in the studio over the weekend. So hoping to kind of revamp how we do all our videos and make them more frequent. We have a more concrete video setup. It should be finished today, I think. But anyways, I appreciate everyone listening and fired up about the show. So let's get to the show.
That's why I don't read the newspaper, because it's garbage. And the editor that let it come out is garbage.
Or do you do what everybody else in the media does, just create some shit and throw it on the wall and see what sticks, which is what I see happening everywhere.
Where are we at in society today? I'm a man. I'm 40.
When my time on earth is gone and my activities here are past, I want they bury me upside down and my critics can kiss my
Is that how it went to choke a bitch?
All right, welcome to episode 55, Menace of Sports. Let's get right into it. First of all, for my favorite segment of the week, every week, and I appreciate all the submissions, please keep them coming. If you hear the dumbest shit you've ever heard in your life from a sports media personality, submit it to us for the dumbass sports media personality of the week. And this week, if you didn't follow social media, I responded to a tweet because it's just narrative writing 101. So this guy, George Reitster, I'm not familiar with who he is. I know he's a West Coast guy, big Oregon guy. He's on Fox Radio somewhere out west. I'm not entirely sure, nor do I really care. But he tweeted out, 2018 Ohio State fans, we are glad Joe Burrow transferred. He is not good anyway, and we didn't want him. 2019 Buckeye fans, look at the three Buckeyes for the Heisman Trophy. Me, shake my head. And I was just sitting here like, man, is that a narrative if I've ever heard it? Because I was here at Ohio State when all of that was going down. Not only do I know the feelings amongst players, coaches, and the fans. I mean, I was watching and hearing the fans talk about how they wanted Joe to stay. And there was a decent amount of the fan base that wanted Joe Burrow to be the quarterback and thought that he, you know, because he outperformed Dwayne Haskins in the spring, and then he got hurt, and then it was just up. It was in limbo, and that was really it. He didn't lose the job to Dwayne. No one wanted him to leave. No one thought he was the second best. It's just that because he got hurt after the spring, he was, I guess, worried that he might lose the job and thought, you know what, if I go somewhere else, we'll both be great players. And that's what he did. And that's what happened. People forget that Joe Burrow, quote unquote, got beat out by a first-round draft pick quarterback. And now Joe Burrow is going to be a first-round draft pick quarterback. But at the end of the day, one of them had to win the job. It's just bizarre that we want to write this narrative like, oh, he sucked. He was thrown away by Ohio State. What? No, he wasn't. Ohio State coaches and fans and players and everyone thought he, like, the receiver room is the greatest barometer for the quarterback play. You want to find out how they feel about a quarterback, go talk to the receivers. All the way from Braxton Miller to JT Barrett to Cardale Jones to Dwayne Haskins, Joe Burrow, you right down the list. You ask the receivers because they're the ones that will tell you the truth. Like, nah, man. Like, when JT left, it was like, okay, now Dwayne's going to be the guy or Joe's going to be the guy. And it was 50-50. I used to ask the room all the time, like, all right, if you had to pick it right now, who would it be? And they to a T, every time we talked about it, it was 50-50. The room was split. Half of them thought Joe should be the guy. Half of them thought Dwayne could be the guy. But realistically, the whole room knew that it didn't really matter. Both would be phenomenal. And it made me think about what a crime to Nebraska that Joe Burrow is doing what he's doing at LSU right now. I mean, they could have had him twice. He would have went to Nebraska over anywhere in the country twice. His dad has a long history with Nebraska. His brother, and he wanted to be at Nebraska so bad. And then he didn't get recruited by Nebraska coming out of high school and obviously came to Ohio State. And then when he went to transfer, that was Scott Frost had just come in. And I think the quote that people said Scott Frost said was, he's not better than what we have right now. I mean, it's just another guy. And so they didn't pursue him, didn't think he was good enough. And it's like hindsight's 20/20, man. You imagine Scott Frost and what he would have right now if he had Joe Burrow. I mean, he obviously would have to develop him like Joe Brady has done a phenomenal job of. But just crazy because he wanted to be at Nebraska. Nebraska fans everywhere should be just sick about it. But either way, really excited about Joe. He's going to win the Heisman on Saturday. I think everyone knows that. Really cool. Obviously, the other three guys, Ohio State has two guys there. Chase Young made it. Justin Fields made it. And then Jalen Hurts. And I think they pretty much got it right. I think those are the four players that deserve to be there. The biggest issue with the Heisman is who votes for it. If that's public, I need to find out. I'm going to get a list and see who is voting on this. But the other thing is the process is bizarre. One, you can vote before championship games. The ballots go out before the championship game. So you can legitimately vote, send it in, and then Joe Burrow could play terrible and you had already voted him to win the Heisman. And it's like, wait a minute, he just played terrible in the championship game. Fortunately, he didn't. He played phenomenal, which we'll talk about later in the show. But why is that allowed? Why are people allowed to vote before the biggest game of the year for some of these kids? It's stupid. Not only that, there's not a uniform ballot. I know people famously talk about when Tim Tebow didn't win the Heisman a second time, he wasn't even on the ballot in the Southwest region. And it's like, how is that possible? How can you allow a player that is going to be in the top three, arguably, before voting, how can you allow them to not be on the ballot? It's just bizarre. But the Heisman is bizarre, and we're going to talk about that after the awards. So next week we'll have a show talking about some of these awards, like Chase Young won the Bronco Nagurski Award, which is phenomenal, well-deserved. But award shows are different. And the other thing we're going to talk about, obviously, this is action-packed. This episode is going to be huge. It's going to be talking about the championship games. We're going to talk about the playoffs a little bit. And then next episode, we have an awesome, awesome guest. We had her before. Anna Hickey's coming back on to talk about this Clemson-Ohio State matchup, what's going on in Clemson country. And I know a lot of people loved when she came on last time. So she'll be on the episode. We're going to do the interview Thursday afternoon-ish. So it'll probably go out Thursday night to Patreon, maybe Friday morning to the rest of yous. And really excited about it. So a lot of great episodes, a lot of great content coming up, some interviews, some great discussions, and then obviously the huge playoffs. And how about the playoff rankings? Everyone's talked about it, and I purposely wanted to put this episode out maybe a day or two after everyone discussed it, because it's like, all right, I'm going to let everyone else talk, and then I'm going to give you my opinion. And so the big news was Ohio State loses the one seed. And I'm not saying LSU doesn't deserve the one seed, because they kind of do. I mean, they're you can make an argument for both cases. Obviously, the top 25 wins, top 10 wins. There's all these analytics and things you could make a case. But the issue I have is why? Why did they make the switch at the end? They always do this bullshit. They make a switch in the final rankings, and it's like, but what did you base that on? Because Georgia was, and we'll get to Georgia in a minute, but so LSU dismantled Georgia. That's a fact. Georgia's terrible. I don't give a fuck what anyone says. They are terrible. Their defense was overrated. Their offense is putrid, and LSU beat them like they should. Just like, and then Ohio State struggled in the first half, ended up coming back in the second half and having a handily fought battle that they won at the end. and somehow you switch them. I don't understand the criteria of the playoff committee. And so we are going to next week, I'm going to go person by person through the playoff committee and talk about who's on it, why they're on it, what do they know. I mean, some of these guys are like 78-year-old coaches, and it's like having Lee Corso on there to pick them. Like, what do they even watch? Do they even know modern football? It's like I couldn't go back and evaluate the 1972 season because it's a completely different game. But we'll talk about the committee in depth next week. The wildest part about the playoff rankings was that a couple things. One, they were debating if Oklahoma or Georgia should get in the fourth spot. Like, what the fuck? What's the debate? Georgia has been horrendous all year on offense. Horrendous. They are without their best wide receiver and will be for the playoffs. They got their ass handed to them by LSU and can't do shit on offense against an average at best defense in LSU. What was the debate? I could make a debate for another team, but not fucking Georgia. What type of pencil pushing 75-year-old used to be coach asses are on this committee? Like, that is real? Georgia? So that's just a bizarre, bizarre discussion. Not only that they like had that debate, but then like to publicly say it is like, you really just said that and told everyone? Oh my God. You just screamed incompetence when you brought that up. So I think next week maybe next episode, we'll see. I really am excited to do it. We're going to break down the committee members, talk about bowl matchups. We're going to bring back our Clemson correspondent, Anna Hickey, to talk about this huge semifinal matchup with Ohio State. We're going to talk Oklahoma-LSU later in next week. And we're also going to do a deep analysis of the final four teams episodically. Starting next week, we're going to go one team, four episodes. So over the next 2 weeks, to give you a clear picture prior to the games of who I think each team is, the deficiencies. I mean, really, it's going to be deep analysis, like I've given you a number of times, so really excited about it. But the first game I want to talk about is one of the playoff teams, the Big 12 championship game. What a game. And you know what? What an incredible job Matt Rhule has done at Baylor. I mean, Charlie Brewer gets hurt, then the backup gets hurt, and then Matt Rhule leads Baylor to a heartbreaking overtime loss with his third string quarterback against a playoff team. He deserves Coach of the Year. And I love Ryan Day. I love Eddie O. I love some of these coaches that have done phenomenal things. But what Matt Rhule has done, he deserves to be the Eddie Robinson Coach of the Year. It's unbelievable. Give it to him now. Like, wow. But the reality is that in that game, you cannot lose. And I've said it every episode. People get sick of it almost, or people love it. The reality is you can't lose the missed tackle battle. Go 3 for 16 on third and fourth down, average 1 yard per carry for 35 total rushing yards, and expect to win the game. The only reason this game went to overtime at all and was even a close game was Oklahoma turned the ball over twice. But it's concerning that a team can be dominated as much as Baylor was and still go to overtime in a tight game. And that's why I think Oklahoma is the weakest link in the playoffs. But we will get to that Oklahoma analysis next week. But they are hitting their stride at the right time, I will tell you that. Jalen Hurts was outstanding, and the soon-to-be Biletnikoff Award winner, CeeDee Lamb, was phenomenal. 17 of 24, almost 300 yards, and Hurts was just methodical all game. He was 11 of 11 and plays under 10 yards, was just efficiency. He was 3 of 4 on shot plays, so explosive. He looked really good, and even better when he got the ball in number two's hands. I mean, Jesus, CeeDee Lamb, 8 catches, 173 yards. And then all the credit in the world goes to Alex Grinch. I mean, 3 missed tackles on the game. This, if you don't remember, this is an Oklahoma team that was like last in the country last year in missed tackles. I want to say 150 or something absurd. 3 missed tackles in a championship game. Baylor had 10. So there you go again, double-digit missed tackles. Or if you just lose the missed tackle battle, you're going to lose the game. And the go figure, perfect segue into the one championship game that was not true. Pac-12 championship game, Oregon missed 12 tackles, Utah missed 7. But we knew Utah had a solid defense. But that you talk about a sickening game, for me at least. Oregon, first of all, I knew it was going to be a long day for Utah when Oregon stuffed Utah on fourth down on the opening drive and drove down and scored and set the tone for the whole game. It was over at that point in my mind. And Oregon played like the team that I picked to win the Pac-12 and go to the playoff. It's sickening, sickening what happened in the Arizona State game, because they would be in right now over Oklahoma. But the other thing is Justin Herbert, how about running the football? He was not a statue at all. He had 8, listen to this, Justin Herbert had 8 designed runs in the championship game. 8, which you'd say that's not a ton. He averaged 0.7 designed runs per game. So what, over 8 times as many in this game? Ridiculous. And he's not a statue. He's athletic. He can run. He really had some huge first down pickups and huge runs against this defense. And I think it was one of those things where Oregon knew Utah was a good defense, and they knew that they needed to equate numbers by involving their quarterback, who was a good athlete. It kind of reminds me of Ohio State and Justin Fields, where they don't want to run him because he's their franchise, but in a game like that, it might be time to take the chains off, and they did it. The other kid is Kayvon Thibodeau. Oh, my God. I mean, he was the number one player in the country, true freshman, but he is a monster. I mean, he had 9 sacks this year as a freshman, but he had 2.5 in that game. He was simply unblockable. I mean, even plays that he didn't get home and get the sack, he was right there, especially when they gave him a one-on-one. So he can go ahead and discount, enjoy that from this season, because next season he will never face a one-on-one. He is very Chase Young-esque at a young age. So I mean, he was the most impressive player in the entire game. The other thing that happened in that game, Tyler Huntley threw 2 interceptions all season and then threw 2 in this game. I've talked about him at length about how he was just an efficient quarterback, not a great quarterback, but efficient, didn't turn the ball over. They had a good run game with Zach Moss. They had a great defense. It was like that stereotypical championship caliber team, and he was that quarterback that would get it done, and he did not get it done in this game. 2 picks, 1 for 6 down the field, an inexcusable 52% completion without pressure. That means when he wasn't pressured, he only completed half of his balls. You can't do that. And then the real story here was C.J. Verdell had a great game. I mean, those 2 long touchdowns, 1 at the end of the game, but it wasn't even anything exceptional. Utah forgot how to play gap sound defense and stay in their damn gaps. And what that means is, so if you think, just look at how an offensive lines up, right? In between each player is a gap. On defense, I mean, there's 2 different, we could talk about this at length, but on defense, there's 2 different styles of defense, really. There is a gap sound defense where every man on defense is associated with a gap. They have that gap in between the center and guard. That is my gap. No one is to run in your gap. And if everyone is in their gap and plays it correctly and doesn't get out of their gap, there's nowhere to run the football. That's one way. Another way is to do what's called 2 gapping, where now you line guys up heavier on the linemen, like head up, and they just play them square, and they essentially play both gaps, and the linebacker behind them plays into whichever gap they don't fit into, if that makes sense. They compensate off of each other. So those are the two main styles of defense. And Utah incorporates kind of a gap sound defense. And I'm watching some of these long runs, and it's like C.J. Verdell doesn't do anything exceptional. It's not an exceptional scheme. It's not motions that get people out of position. It's a defensive end dives in the wrong gap, and there's no one in a gap, and C.J. Verdell hits it for a 60-yard touchdown or whatever it was. I mean, 18 carries, 208 yards, and 3 touchdowns. Utah absolutely shit the bed on defense. That's just reality of what happened. And Oregon finally played like they should have played all year. And they had flashes like this all year. Justin Herbert played well, but that, you can't, I mean, come on. They should be a playoff team. They looked like a playoff team. I mean, you're talking about a last second touchdown against Auburn, the first game of the year. That should have been their only loss. It was really a coaching error. And then you go shit the bed against Arizona State. And now here we are. Unbelievable. But I will tell you, week 2 of 2020, the Buckeyes are going out to Oregon, and Menace to Sports is going to be there. That's going to be a game that we have to see. Obviously, Justin Herbert will be gone, but that Oregon team is different than the Oregon of old, the Chip Kelly Oregon. It's really different because they have an offensive line head coach, and he is taking that Oregon flash, that Oregon skill, that pretty uniforms, that Nike money, and he's adding toughness and offensive line play to it. Watch out for Oregon. I'm telling you, Mario Cristobal is going to get it done there because he's bringing an element that Oregon never had, that toughness, offensive line play, running the football, power run game, doing that stuff with the Oregon brand. Yeah, it's really going to be exciting to see, and I'd watch out for them. But we definitely want to get to the Big Ten Championship game and the SEC Championship game. Really excited about those 2 games to talk about them. Really going to talk a lot about the Big Ten Championship game for obvious reasons. And really just kind of close out with the championship week, and then preview with the playoffs, what's coming. So we're going to take a quick break with one of our sponsors, and we'll be right back after this. I have a question for you. Which of your online searches does the government have the right to know about? Whether it's maybe your late night theatrics or your antics, or maybe the fact that you have a Pinterest account. Does the government deserve to know about those searches? The answer, none of them. If you have ExpressVPN, they won't. Without ExpressVPN's protection, though, hackers, governments, ad companies, and ISPs all have full access to your data. I don't want them using my web history or video searches against me. That's why I use ExpressVPN every time I go online. ExpressVPN encrypts and reroutes your web traffic to any number of countries, keeping you safer and secure. Simply download the ExpressVPN app, click to connect, and boom, you're protected. With ExpressVPN, you can make it seem like you're browsing from a different country, so you can watch any Netflix library in the world you want. How cool is that? ExpressVPN is the fastest VPN I've tried. It costs less than $7 per month and comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. It's time to stop governments and internet companies from keeping tabs on your data. Take back your online privacy like I did with ExpressVPN. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/menace. That's expressvpn.com/menace for 3 months free with a 1-year package. Visit expressvpn.com/menace to learn more. All right, welcome back. Well, we have two playoff teams that played also in championship games. And I think the real storyline here is you have four conference champions playing. The Big 12 champ, the Big 10 champ, the ACC champ, and the SEC champ. That's the way it should be. You should have to win your conference to make the playoffs, and I'm glad they stuck to that. But the SEC championship was actually not as close as I thought. I said it preseason. The preview was that it's going to be a battle of whose weakness is weaker, and it was so evident whose weakness was weaker, Georgia. But starting with our critical stat, missed tackles. Georgia had 10, LSU had 7, so really great job by the LSU defense getting guys on the ground. And this was really a tale of opposite offenses. You couldn't be more polar opposite. You start with Joe Burrow, who won the Heisman Trophy again. He already won it, but now he won it again on Saturday. Absolute stud. 350 yards passing, 4 touchdowns, 0 picks. He is unbelievable at when something's not there. He can escape the pocket. He can extend the length of a play and give his receivers time to get open. And boy, does he have some receivers. He is the catalyst that is just, I mean, it takes an offense. And even when you stop this LSU offense, he finds a way to give it time to spring open, and all of a sudden a well-defended play, a well-executed defense can give up a 60-yard gain because of Joe Burrow's ability to do that. It was unbelievable. Joe Burrow was a stud. Jake Fromm was a dud. And I'm not happy because I would like to see him have success, but it's just hilarious that I've said this all year long. Georgia fans hate it. They've been on my ass. And then you watch the game and it's like, really? Really? I'm cool. Just let's be honest here. Let's be honest. 1 for 10 down the field. 10% down the field. 44% completions and 2 interceptions when he had no pressure. Think about that. With no one pressuring him, he completed 44% of his balls and threw 2 interceptions. That is flat, poor quarterback play. There's no other way about it. It's not like they blitzed him and he was under pressure and threw a bad ball. It's no pressure. If it's not there, you can scramble, throw it away. Don't throw 2 picks when you're not under pressure. And the most unbelievable thing to me at Georgia the last half of the season, if I'm a Georgia fan, I'm pissed, because how does James Coley not found a way to get DeAndre Swift the fucking football? He's their best, most dynamic player. He never gets the ball. It's like, who are you? Oh my gosh, it just is mind-blowing. All you want to do as a coach is get the ball to your best players as many times as possible. Look at some of the great failures in football in my career. 2015, Michigan State. Who didn't touch the ball? Ezekiel Elliott, Michael Thomas. 2 of the best at their position in the NFL right now. Look at Georgia. Why have they sucked for 7 weeks and really all season? They have DeAndre Swift, who's a really, really, really good player, and they don't ever give it to him. He had 2 carries, 3 catches. And people say, oh, he was hurt. He's not 100%. Did you listen to Kirby Smart in his post-game interview? They asked people, the questions came. Well, update us on DeAndre Swift. Is he 100%? Is he injured? And Kirby Smart said, he's healthy as far as I know. He's fine. It's like, what? And the way he answered is like, oh, we're the idiots. No. You're not giving the ball to your best player. Why? Is he hurt? No. Well, then what's your fucking reason, bro? Like, do we have offensive coordinators that know how to coordinate an offense, call a play, and actually get the ball to good players? No? No? Okay. I am in complete shock that anyone on the committee would even consider this Georgia team, and more shocked that they admitted it publicly. I just can't. Their offense is so putrid. And the vaunted, amazing defense that I heard about from Georgia gave up almost 500 yards, 50% on third down, created zero turnovers. They stopped the run decent, but Joe Burrow carved them up with the help of Justin Jefferson and Terrence Marshall. It was a bloodbath. And despite their inconsistency and at times shockingly gross performances, the LSU defense is certainly capable of playing decent. They haven't at times. They're very inconsistent. But I will tell you this, Derek Stingley Jr. is the second best corner I have watched all year behind Jeff Okuda. You can save your CJ Henderson talks. You can save your Trayvon Diggs talks. Derek Stingley Jr. is the second best defensive back I've seen outside of Jeff Okuda. And Grant Delpit, as critical as I've been on him, because he misses a ton of tackles, but he's all over the field. He is all over the field, and he's an impact player. And here you go, Georgia. Here's a brilliant game plan, and this might be worse for James Coley than not giving it to DeAndre Swift. They threw the ball at Stingley 16 times. Six fucking teen. Five catches, 57 yards, one PBU, and two interceptions. That was your game plan? Throw the ball at their best cover guy? Really smart plan by James Coley. That, I tell you, no wonder Georgia belongs in the playoffs. It was a joke. But in the end, this 37-10 ass-whooping proved that in the battle of whose weakness was weakest, LSU's defense was far superior to that dog shit offense that Georgia rolled out on the field. No pun intended, Ugga. So I think LSU proved that they are a force to be reckoned with. We know that. I think their defense is still suspect, but they played better on Saturday. I'll give them that. And I also get against who that offense is horrible. But excited to break down LSU in depth because I want to talk about scheme next week. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to go one team that's in the playoff every episode until the playoffs. Starting next week, and we're going to talk about what they do schematically, their personnel at every position, their strengths and weaknesses, and really talk about what I see happening in each game. And the good thing is in these types of games, anything can happen. Like, there's not an analyst in the country that can accurately predict, because I can see Oklahoma beating LSU. I can see either Ohio State or Clemson winning, and that's just off the hoof of just what I've watched all year. So really want to analyze that next week. But first, let's talk about the Big Ten Championship. Obviously spent a lot of time on this. The first thing I'm going to say is what a team game, what a team win. And the special teams performance by Ohio State was different than it's been all year. It was a wow factor. First of all, the fake punt. Holy brass nuts. I mean, on your own 26, 4th and 9, and Ryan Day calls a fake punt. And then I want to come back to that, but then the punt block team, and people won't recognize this because they didn't block a punt, but they showed their ass. They showed too early that they were coming after a punt. The punter saw it, and that's when he pissed down his leg, dropped the ball, and all of a sudden it's a huge momentum swing, and Ohio State gets the ball deep in Wisconsin's territory. It was a huge play that people won't talk about, but I want to talk about the fake punt because it reminded me of the 2006 SEC Championship game. We're playing Arkansas. We end up going on to hindsight, we go on to win the national title, beat Ohio State. But we're playing Arkansas. Momentum's against us. And Urban decides to run a fake punt in a very similar situation. I think it was on our 19, but similar, 4th and 9 on our own 19. And he calls a reverse, which is even more scary than throwing a pass because you're going to have to run backwards 10 yards and then get those 10 back and another 9. But it ended up working out, and it really shifted momentum. And I can't imagine that didn't play a part in why Ryan Day called that play, because it was a critical moment. Momentum was in limbo, and Ryan Day calls the fake punt, gets the first down, and you feel momentum start to shift. But I wanted to talk about it because I was watching it, and Ryan is so insightful, and he knows these things. And to be honest with you, not a lot of coaches do, not a lot of head coaches do, because I've been a big part of special teams my whole career. And Urban taught me this, and it's so true, is anytime it's 4th down, I was a punt block coach. I was in charge of punt block like my first 4 or 5 years at Ohio State. And all we would do is when we called punt block, you would stare across the side, across the field at the other head coach, because 98% of the time that head coach, if it's just a punt, just a regular punt, that head coach is over talking to his quarterback, making adjustments, talking about the drive that obviously stalled because you're punting, and he has no interest in the punt. He's just the punt, the special teams guys handling the punt. And so he's talking to his players, getting adjustments. What happens 95% of the time, a team calls a fake punt, that head coach has laser focus on the play, on the fake punt. And if you see it, you can call timeout or get your guys in punt safe, because you know he shouldn't be that interested in a punt. He's actually interested because he's nervous and he wants to make sure that the fake punt works. And so if you ever watch it on TV, watch the head coach. And Ryan Day did a good job. He was kind of trying not to watch, trying not to pay attention so that he didn't tip his hat or tip his hand that, you know, not tip his hat, tip his hand at what he just called. And it was unbelievable. Now, everyone's going to talk about Ohio State's missed tackles in this game. And they had a ton in the first half. They cleaned it up. They cleaned it up. So the highest of the season by far, they had 11 missed tackles, and almost all of them were in the first half. So that, I mean, you're talking about they were on course for a 20 missed tackle game, and it was bad. I mean, it was bad. I was sick to my stomach for them. But you want to talk about really bad? Wisconsin had 30 missed tackles. Wow, you want to lose? That's how you lose. Oh my, 30 missed tackles. But it definitely was the tale of two halves. I mean, Ohio State's down 21-7 at half. The halftime adjustments were outstanding. Second time this year that it was just a completely different team came out of the tunnel in the second half. They had five straight scoring drives, 27 unanswered points, and a dominant display of what this team is capable of and should play like for four quarters. And will need to beat this Clemson team. They cannot have a bad half. They need four quarters like they played in the second half, or they will lose. And sometimes I say stuff on this show and Buckeye fans don't like it or don't want to hear it. PSA, Buckeye fans, they will have to play their very best game against Clemson, and they will win if they do. But if they do not, they will lose. So just remember that. It was really, this game was a field position game, and the difference in halves showed how critical three phases working cohesively is to a team's success in huge games. I mean, the offense gets two first downs. The punt team has a great punt with zero return yards. The defense holds them. Punt block can move your checkers closer and closer to the opponent's end zone. That is the name of the game. That's how you win big games. Your offense doesn't need to score every drive. It'd be nice. Everyone would like it. But just get two first downs. That's 20 yards. Now you punt it. 45-yard net. Now you just change the field 65 yards. If you can get a three and out or stop them, don't let them get the same two first downs. Now you've just created a 30-yard differential. You keep doing that consistently, you're going to win the game. And that's what happened. In the first half, Ohio State started their average drive on the 22-yard line, their own 22. In the second half, on their own 40, almost midfield. That is 18 yards per drive in hidden yardage in the second half. That is 108 yards just in the second half gained just in the field position battle in the second half over the first half. That is huge. That is legitimately, think about it. That's like saying, all right, we're going to roll out this other player that's going to get 108 yards in the second half for us and help us win this game. That's what the team element of the game did. Wisconsin, their average starting field position in the second half was the 21. Ohio State was on the 40. They were on the 21, their own 21. That is massively important. But talking about Ohio State's offense, it showed its ass again, and I've been critical of it. No one likes to talk about it. Everyone wants to talk about this is the best offensive line, the best team, best this, no flaws, blah, blah, blah. That's not been true ever all year, not once, and I've said it every show. I've been honest. I've called out what needs improved, what's not playing well, who's not playing well, but people don't want to talk about it. I listen to some of these other shows and analysts and Buckeye fans, and it's like, I mean, I don't see a weakness on the whole team, and I'm like, what the shit are you watching? There are some weaknesses. Though they're not that bad, there are definitely weaknesses. 23 total QB pressures and 5 sacks. Pass pro is a weakness. And, I mean, you talk about Xavier Thomas coming to town. I mean, that's the second-best defensive player in the country behind Chase Young at Clemson. 23 total QB pressures. Thayer Mumford had 3. Jonah Jackson had 0. Josh Myers had 3. Wyatt Davis had 2. Brandon Bowen had 2. J.K. had 3. So Jonah Jackson actually played phenomenal, and he's been great all year. And we're going to talk about that when we preview Ohio State next week. But I've said it all year, and no one wants to listen. The pass protection, specifically by the tackles and JK, are an issue. Saturday, Josh Myers and Wyatt Davis looked like they did at the start of the season. They've improved, and they've actually been doing very well in pass pro, but they had kind of a setback game. I mean, Josh Myers allowed three pressures, and that was how he was playing early in the year when I was being critical of him. And he cleaned it up. I at one point said he was probably the most improved player on offense. The other thing is 3.7 yards per carry. That's deflated because of the sacks. So that's obviously not a good day rushing the football, but when you get sacked five times, that's going to lower your yards per carry. So I'm not as concerned about that, but it certainly was not a dominant rushing day for the Buckeyes. The reality was, and I haven't heard people talk about this enough, zone six dominated this secondary in hindsight. The lowest graded three players on defense for Wisconsin were their three corners. Think about that. The receiver group played extremely well in the second half specifically, with the only drop being Ben Victor had one drop. But the thing that I saw that I haven't seen a lot of is they were elusive. KJ Hill and Ben Victor forced 10 missed tackles combined. 10. And the receiver group moved the chains a combined 14 times. 14 times the receivers caught passes and got first downs. The top five graded players on offense on Saturday, you're talking about the biggest game of the year, right? Championship game to go to the playoffs. The top five graded players, Chris Olave 1, KJ Hill 2, Ben Victor 3, JK 4, Austin 5. JK played really well outside of pass pro, but that's four receivers in the top five. And it's safe to say Justin Fields' supporting cast showed up. And Brian Hartline's zone six came to play. Now, I will say this. Justin Fields played above average at best. Superman was not super all game long, but it's not all on him. You can't blame him entirely because here's the reality. He was 76% completion when he was kept clean, when he didn't have pressure. He had a 30% completion percentage when he was under pressure. What does that tell you? Pass pro was the biggest issue on offense. That and Fields not getting rid of the ball on time. And at times the receivers weren't always open, but I watched the film. I mean, I'm a receiver coach by trade. They played really well. They were open most of the time. I think Justin Fields needs to make some better decisions and get rid of the ball, and the pass pro needs to hold up. That's just the reality of it. You can't go 30% under pressure, or if you do, you better not be under pressure a lot. And that's what I saw from this offense. Now, on defense, Ohio State came out for the third quarter and was a different defense than they were in the second half. They allowed 16 plays for 23 yards and 0 points in the third quarter. They completely flipped the momentum. And the final dagger was towards the end of the third quarter and start of the fourth quarter when the Silver Bullet defense forced back-to-back three and outs for a grand total of 8 yards and six plays. And the offense took advantage and scored 10 points in response to both drives. That is what I'm talking about when I say a team win, team game. When the defense is back-to-back three and outs, the offense is getting much improved field position. Now they're putting up points. Now the momentum's shifting. Now the train's rolling downhill a little bit. And that's what happened. Those two drives were the turning point. Towards the end of the third quarter, start of the fourth quarter, those two three and outs changed the entire trajectory of the game. But I will tell you this, Wisconsin had a very clear game plan, and it was very simple in the throw game. Go after Damon Arnette. That was their game plan. They obviously see and viewed him as a weakness, which I can't disagree, but they targeted Arnette 13 times. Comparatively, they targeted all the linebackers combined 8 times. They targeted Arnette 13 times. They targeted Okuda 4 times and Cam Brown 2 times, and Okuda had some bizarre injury that was like a concussion that healed at halftime, so he was able to come back, thank God, but they went after Damon Arnette. That was the plan. And here's the other part. At times, most of the time, it worked. 6 catches for 84 yards on 13 targets. That's not a great day. And the reality is this. Anytime you see a box score, anytime you look at a game, when one of your corners is the leading tackler in the game, he did not have a good day. He did not. Unless he's a nickel and blitzing and doing all kinds of things. If he's a cover corner like Damon Arnette is, he did not have a good game. That means his guy caught the ball quite a bit. But Wisconsin had one other game plan that was pretty obvious. I think everyone's seen this. Everyone's talked about this. They were going to commit minimally 3 people to Chase Young and avoid him absolutely taking the entire game over. He still, and this is how dominant Chase Young is, he still managed 4 QB pressures. He didn't record a sack. I get it. So it's not cute and pretty and all that. But for the second game in a row, after recording at least 1 sack in every game of the year, he had 0 sacks. So that means back-to-back games, 0 sacks. And here's teams know he's a problem. And they aren't going to allow him to have a one-on-one. To be honest, I'm shocked it took this long. I mean, we were watching games mid-season, and I would watch the film like, why are they trying to do this? You're going to block that freak of nature with one human being, or maybe just a slight chip from a running back? He's still going to get home. But teams finally caught on, finally figured it out. They know he's a problem, and they're not going to let it happen. And Clemson's not going to let it happen. If Ohio State moves on to the national championship, neither Oklahoma or LSU is going to let it happen. So just get used to it. It's what they're going to do. But what was also surprising was how little the defensive staff tried to move him around to create mismatches. They did stand him up a little bit. You watch the first Wisconsin game. That's all they were trying to do was get him one-on-ones, get him to have mismatches, get him to move around so you don't know where he's going. And they didn't do as much of it. And the other thing they didn't do, I mean, just think about this now. Think about it. Like, open your mind and don't even think about football. Just think about humans. If we have, let's say, six or seven people in pass protection, if we take three of them and put them all attention on one guy, as a defensive coach, you can attack the other side because you know that's going to happen. You can bring blitzes from the other side. You can twist defensive linemen because you know you're getting one-on-ones. You know they're weaker in protection over there. So attack. I mean, if I was, I would blitz opposite of Chase Young every third down. Just say, all right, block Chase with three guys. We're going to bring Baron Brown and Malik Harrison off the edge, and now you got a real problem on your hands. And now when you want to slide it to them, Chase is one-on-one, or at least one and a half on one. That's what was the most surprising thing. There wasn't a lot of creativity to take advantage of all the attention Wisconsin and Michigan, for that matter, gave to Chase. All in all, they got to Jack Cohn twice for sacks. But what they did was they pressured and unsettled him 20 times. So 20 QB pressures is significant. That's a decent day. And you look at the top five grades on defense: Jayshon Cornell, Tuff Borland, Chase Young, Davon Hamilton, Jeff Okuda. That's about what I saw. Tuff is a little higher than I thought he was, but he played well. I didn't think he didn't play well. But what Ohio State had, there was not a schemed up anything. They were not getting their ass kicked in the first half. They just were missing tackles. And it's a lot like we talked about with Utah. They were missed some tackles. They were out of some gaps. And then they just flat, like Pete Warner had the glaring one right in the hole. Just make the tackle. Get him on the ground. And it's not to take away from Jonathan Taylor, who's a great back. But you're there. You're a linebacker at Ohio State. You're in the hole. It's not like an open field tackle with 10 yards of space. Get him on the ground. That's the biggest improvement you saw in the second half was tackling. They started tackling better. And then it was complete team defense or complete team football for Ohio State. So kudos to Ryan Day. Kudos to really the entire staff and the special teams. We haven't talked a lot about special teams, but man, was that a huge impact component of that game. So it'll be really interesting to see how that continues, because when you get in these big games like this, the Big Ten championship, the playoffs, da-da-da-da-da, you better have those impact moments. You better block a punt. You better return a punt. You better, force turnovers. You need those momentum swinging moments to win the game. That's just the nature of championship caliber football. But that's enough about that. We will do a deep dive next week, starting next week, the next 2 weeks, starting next Monday, into the four playoff teams. Talk about some of the bowl matchups. Really exciting time, because as I've said from preseason on, the bowl matchups are where you find out what conference is real. And now we could really talk about the politics of getting advantageous matchups for the SEC that ESPN drives. But either way, if the Big Ten goes out and beats some SEC teams, they will solidify that they're the best conference, or vice versa. If the SEC goes out and just dominates every bowl game, you can't argue with it. But my point is, you could never argue it all year because you don't know. You're going to find out. It's bowl season, baby. So thank you for tuning in. Thank you for listening. I really appreciate it. As always, if you're interested in sponsorship and advertising, reach out at Zach@MenaceToSocietyPodcast.com. Stay tuned. Trying to finalize maybe a watch party for the semifinal game. And if we do, it's going to blow the tailgate out of the water. As awesome as the tailgate was and as big of a success it was, we learned from what minor mistakes we made, and we're going to improve it. And it should be a great time. So come hang out with us. I'll give you more details hopefully next week. And really excited, man. Don't stay tuned. Make sure you check out our next episode coming out probably tomorrow night, maybe Friday for the public, Friday morning with Anna Hickey and Clemson. And let's talk about this matchup a little bit. But as always, thank you for tuning in. Thank you for listening. We appreciate you. I hope you liked it. Hope you were entertained. And as we say, if you didn't, go fuck yourself, San Diego.
That's why I don't read the newspaper, because it's garbage. And the editor that let it come out is garbage.
Or do you do what everybody else in the media does, just create some shit and throw it on the wall and see what sticks, which is what I see happening everywhere.
Where are we at in society today? I'm a man. I'm 40.
When my time on Earth is gone and my activities here are past, I want they bury me upside down and my critics can kiss my
Is that how it went to Chuck Dixon?